Hi, and welcome to the Finally Pregnant podcast, the podcast for people who are finally pregnant after infertility and loss. I'm your host, Kat Strawbridge, and after almost 7 years trying, multiple rounds of fertility treatment, which have sadly included pregnancy loss, I am finally pregnant. Hi there, and welcome to episode 6. That's 6. I've got it right this week. Of the Finally Pregnant podcast. I'm really keen to talk to you in a bit more detail in the introduction for this episode because 3 weeks into Ren being with us and a whole personal education on breastfeeding makes me think that actually, you know, it would be good to talk about my experience because I felt that I was really prepared for breastfeeding. I'd had this chat with Shell several weeks ago. I'd done a lot of research, as you'll hear me say in the actual interview, and I really felt very prepared. But what happened just took me completely by surprise. It just wasn't what I was expecting. It was much more difficult than I was expecting for various reasons. And so as much as I've talked about a bit of it on my Instagram, I thought I would talk through step by step what we've been through over the last 3 weeks. And also let you know that, you know, we're coming out the other side, which is fantastic. There is a chance that Ren is going to start crying at any moment. She's just outside the door. It's an open door in her pram having a little snooze, but I might have to dash. But yes, so I'll get started. So I had been getting colostrum since 37 weeks. It took a few days to build up. You know, I started off with very, very, very small amounts, but I did get quite significant amount, you know, several mils towards the end of, so towards week 39, because I went in on my 39th week to be induced. It's, you know, I've put some stuff on my Instagram about it, a link to a video to show you how to do it. I will say that I didn't get something every day. And if I wasn't getting something, then I just stopped. You know, I just thought, I'm not going to force this. I went back the next day and it, you know, then I got some. People say things like surround yourself, you know, go and sit in the nursery, surround yourself with baby pictures, with scan pictures, that kind of thing. That's a whole different conversation in itself almost. So contact me if you want some information on that. But I had taken my colostrum to the hospital because I was really keen for Ren to receive that immediately, which, you know, and that's how it worked out. With regards to syringes and things, not all midwives are that interested in the whole colostrum thing. Mine wasn't particularly, but it was something that I was really keen on. I had to go to the hospital to get the syringes, which isn't great, but you know, I did it. I happened to be there for a scan anyway. So just to let you know that, you know, just because they say no doesn't mean it's not possible. So Ren was born on the 10th of June and we immediately had skin to skin. You know, that was something I was really, really keen on because I'd been told it's good to help bring your milk on as much amongst lots of other things. I did try to breastfeed within the first hour, but unfortunately that wasn't to be. They're just so tiny, to be honest, and I know that some do, and I was really keen for Ren to be one of those, but it wasn't the case, and that's fine. We stayed in hospital until day 3, so when they're born that starts off at day 0. So as I talk about the days, you know, that's from there. We had a lot of mixed advice. It was an amazing setting to be in. You know, we weren't rushed out of hospital at all. There were loads of midwives. They looked after us, you know, fed us, etc. But there was a lot of mixed advice and it was quite confusing. And it got to the point where I just wanted to get out of there and kind of do it myself at home. Things like overfeeding her, underfeeding her. And I say underfeeding her, it was about letting her get hungry so that hopefully she would latch on. We use things, the little things, they're called cups, which they are cups. And the idea is that the little one laps up the milk from them. It's a weird concept. It was something that I hadn't come across before, but it was a way to make sure they ate that wasn't a bottle. And I'll just say now that one of the things I was really concerned about, because as I will talk to you, someone suggested that I supplement with a bottle and I was dead against it. I really, really wasn't keen at all. And that was because of nipple confusion. I'd heard about something called nipple confusion, that if you give a baby that you want to breastfeed a bottle, then they'll prefer the bottle rather than your nipple. So that was something that I was very, very conscious of, although I have to say it hasn't been a problem at all. So when we left the hospital, literally on the way home, my milk came in properly. Now, I'd had quite a lot of milk already because I had started the colostrum beforehand. But oh my gosh, like I became engorged. My Instagram story was boobs like bricks. Please help. Like they were just solid. It was one of the most uncomfortable things that I've ever experienced. And they just look really weird. Not that that matters, but it was quite painful. And it actually meant that Ren couldn't get her mouth around me. So someone described it as, if you think about a normal kind of breastfeeding boob as a half blown up balloon. So it's easy to kind of get your chops around that. Whereas if you blow the balloon up fully, you can't get your mouth around any part of it. It's just too hard to get hold of. So that's a kind of, it was a good analogy, I thought. Now, this coincided with the day that we tried to kind of encourage her to ask me to feed when she was hungry. And to be honest, I think those 12 hours really set us back. So the issues that we've had are around her weight. Every newborn baby loses weight within the first couple of weeks, and the plan is to get them back to their birth weight within 2 weeks, so by day 14. Ren initially had lost 6.9% when we were in the hospital, which was fine, but day 5, so this is the Saturday to the Monday that she had been born, she had lost just over 10%. It was like 10.6%. So it was over the kind of the threshold of 10%. And the maternity worker I spoke to then, her response was, well, you've just got to give her a bottle. And I thought that was quite lazy. She hadn't really had much of a conversation with me. And to be honest, you know, at that point, I was very against a bottle. And I just said, no, that isn't what I want to do. And she didn't even really have the courage of her conviction. She just kind of said, oh, OK, then we'll come back in 24 hours. And that was it. So I would say, through my experience, you know, the level of care and experience and support you receive, midwife to midwife, maternity worker to maternity worker, and I'll be honest, hand on heart, I'm not sure what the difference is. But the level of care and support that you receive is so different. And Shell says this, I think, in the interview, and I will just say it now, you know, speak to different people because different people will give you different advice. And so day 6 we went back to the hospital to be weighed, as you know, kind of that was the advice that we had been given at that point. And Ren hadn't put on any more weight, but that day we met a maternity worker. Actually, no, that's not true. We met a maternity worker that day, Natalie, who was incredible. And she sat me down and she kind of watched me breastfeed, and I was doing all the right things, but she still managed to tweak all of them. And we fed her, and Ren put on 20 grams in one feed. So it just went to show that, you know, doing it properly, and I say doing it properly, what we did to start with was we got rid of a lot of the milk. She really helped me clear out some of the engorgement so that Ren could actually feed. Like, we literally did that in her office. Like, just, I was dripping, I'm not kidding. It is not very glamorous. And that just showed the difference with those tweaks, with getting rid of like some of the hardness and the engorgement. 20 grams, you know, and they put on, they say on average, between 15 and 30 grams a day. And she had put on 20 grams in one feed. So we knew I could do it. We knew she could do it. We then went on to have a couple of appointments at home with maternity workers, and that was just with me breastfeeding a few days apart, as in the visits were a few days apart, not the breastfeeding. But when someone came in a couple of days later, Ren hadn't put on any weight. She hadn't lost any either, percentage wise, but you know, she hadn't put any on. And at that point, you do start to think something isn't working here, you know. And with hindsight now, I think the thing wasn't working was that we were both still learning. It wasn't any major kind of catastrophe. It was just we were both still learning. And during that meeting, we had the conversation about putting her on a bottle and supplementing every feed with a bottle. Now, when I agreed to it, because at that stage, you know, it's not about my desire to breastfeed. It's about my desire for my daughter to be healthy, you know, and it did, you know, that just clicks over completely. Once you're talking to people that you really trust and can put your faith in, I think that made that much easier. I did have a little cry when that maternity worker left, because I was devastated at the time that, you know, the breastfeeding wasn't necessarily working particularly well, that I was going to have to supplement with a bottle. And so I did, you know, I felt inadequate. And I spoke to Anya, who did the mental health podcast episode for me. And she said, you know, to take out the word adequate and put in the sentence, looking after your daughter. You know, I felt it was important to look after my daughter. Not I felt inadequate, but I felt it more important to look after my daughter. And that made such a difference. And that's what it was. It really was. It was putting Ren first, like I said, not my desire to breastfeed. So we were supplementing every feed. And lo and behold, when they came to weigh her, she had started putting on weight, which was amazing. And we got to day 14, which is like, you know, 2 weeks after she was born. And she had been born at 8 pounds, 5 ounces. And on day 14, she was 8 pounds, 6 ounces. So she was over her birth weight, which for a child who, you know, was over 10% weight loss, you know, I was delighted. I genuinely didn't think that was going to happen. So we, since then, it's been, What we've done is we've reduced the supplements. We're still doing them at every feed, but we've reduced the amount. And Ren is going to be weighed, well, tomorrow, but you're today, if you're listening to this on the day that it's released. So I will hopefully have a baby who is putting on weight, and then we will take out the bottle feeds as of tomorrow, fingers crossed. And I can feel the difference between her feeding now. I really can. And that's why I say, with hindsight, I think it is just a learning process. And so many people, when I put on Instagram about the struggles we were having, have said that, you know, it clicked on day 5, day 10, day 15, day 20. You know, it is just time. They're so little. They're learning to do so much. And so are we, you know, like, this has been a huge learning curve for me. So it's just about, you know, getting into a bit of a rhythm with it and understanding it, and her being coordinated enough to know what she's doing. And one of the things that really helped with all of this, I have to say, is that we went on a 3-hourly routine. And that was, you know, on the hour, every 3 hours, I change her nappy, I feed her, generally with me first. If she's really sleepy, I'll try the bottle first, just to kind of give her a bit of energy and wake her up. And then I have a little cuddle, and then she sleeps. And that's when I try to sleep or eat or, you know, do whatever I can. And that religious 3-hourly routine, I really think, made the difference. And actually, it made life a bit easier for me, even though it meant I was getting up, you know, really regularly and not necessarily getting any or much sleep. I really felt like we got into, you know, a real groove with it. And it just, it made me really just understand her feeding, which is something that I would definitely recommend. As it happens, in the last 24, 48 hours, she has changed. And she's not that interested in the routine anymore. She's waking up when she wants to. But I'm hoping that means we're moving towards her feeding on demand. So she tells me when she's hungry. She wakes up when she's hungry. She will let me know, and then we can feed. And she's doing something, I think, called cluster feeding in the evening, where she kind of feeds a lot in the evening, and then they're more likely to sleep through the night. And I say sleep through the night, you know, not necessarily for 8 hours, but, you know, for a longer period. So yeah, it just, it's all changing, and it's difficult, and it really is. You know, the night feeds are hard. It's very dark. Like, the fact that she's a June baby, I have to say, has been a bit of a godsend for that. So my feeds are at 11 p.m., at 2 a.m. and at 5 a.m. And the only one that's particularly difficult really is the 2 a.m. one, you know, because it is dark and it is, you know, silent. By five, it's light outside and my husband gets up at about 6:30. So, you know, we're still going at that point. And yeah, so that's not too bad. But the 2 a.m. one, it is quite difficult. Headphones. And watching either Netflix or I think it's Amazon Prime, actually, Grey's Anatomy has got me through this. And actually, the headphones in particular are good when you're expressing, because I have been expressing quite a lot and it's quite noisy. So, yeah, just watching something with headphones or listening to podcasts. That's a top tip from me, because even if you have the telly on, you have to turn it up. And if there's other people in your house or the baby's sleeping, you don't want it too loud. So, yeah, headphones are a key tip for you. From me. So that's been, in a very quick nutshell, that's been our last 3 weeks of feeding. It's meant that I have kind of hibernated a bit where visitors are concerned. You know, I did ask for minimal visitors because it is, you know, you want to stick to the routine. It gets a little bit harder at the weekends when people are around, and you want to go out. And so that does make it a bit harder. But I think that it's paying off now. It really is. And Shell does say in the interview, which I'm going to hand over to in a moment, you know, persevere is a word that she hates. And I can understand that completely. However, you know, I say then and I will concur now. And it's funny actually listening to this interview back now that I know what I know and I've been through the experiences. I can say that, yeah, a lot of the advice is really, really good advice, and listen to it. And listen to it again just before you have them to remind yourself. But yes, I'll get back to my point. It is hard work. So although Shell recommends not persevering through too much pain and everything else, it is hard work. But hopefully, and I think I'm getting to the stage now, that the hard work is fairly short-lived. And it will pay off. Secretly, during the recording of this, I've had to pause it and go and grab Ren because she started crying. So I now have her in my arms and I need to go and feed her. So I am going to leave it there. I think I said already, but, you know, contact me because this is in a nutshell. I've just done this very, very quickly. But, you know, if you have any questions, but listen to Shell. And yeah. I hope that you get lots and lots from it. So from us, have a lovely day. Take care. Bye-bye. Hi there. Today we are here with infant feeding specialist Shell Banks. I'll put links to Shell's Instagram and her website, which is shellbanks.co.uk, in the show notes. Shell specialises in unsettled babies, disturbed sleep, formula feeding and faltering growth. She is an internationally board certified lactation consultant and she's based in the northwest of England. There are myriad of things that Shell has been involved in, including working for the NHS in research training, private practices with one-to-ones with mothers. She also does online webinars and so, so much more. I came across Shell because she was recently involved in a Channel 4 show, Dispatches, which was called The Great Formula Milk Scandal. And that was all about formula milk that you can buy from the supermarket, which we will definitely talk about within this conversation. And there are two things that really came across so positively. And when I decided to make this podcast, I knew that Shell was someone that I was really wanted to get on here. So I'm delighted that she's put some time aside to join us. She's clearly very, very experienced. And if that doesn't come across in this podcast, which I know it will, go and have a look at her website. There is so much information on there. But also she's really non-judgmental. And that's something that I really want across all of this podcast. It's, you know, we get told so many different things when we're pregnant and all through our fertility journeys. And I really want people to understand that whatever happens is right for them. And so whether you end up formula feeding your baby or whether you breastfeed your baby, we all have kind of preferences and things we'd like to do. It doesn't necessarily mean, as we all know, that it works out that way. So I really wanted to speak to someone who is non-judgmental, who will cover lots of information, more as an introduction. We'll see how
how nitty gritty we get. I'll shut up now so we can get Shell talking. But yeah, I'm really excited to speak to you. So hello there, Shell. How are you?
I'm all right. Yes. Hi.
I don't know. Is there anything specific that I've missed there that you think that, that kind of really, tell us about what you do and how your day to day works?
Well, I work half time in the NHS training health professionals. And yes, I have a small private practice where I see families. And as you say, specialise in the kind of unsettled baby. I am a lactation consultant. So first and foremost, my initial training is in breastfeeding support. But given where I work, both kind of geographically and metaphysically or whatever, the place that I meet families in, which is often online, I'm working more and more with families who are combination feeding or entirely formula feeding, and their experiences and helping them to get the best from it as well. The only thing that you haven't added in my little bio there, just because it's not being widely publicised yet, is that I've just completed a book on formula, which will be out hopefully this summer, which will be all over my website and which you can talk about when we get there. So as far as the non-judgmental approach, yes, I would really like to think that I am. I'm very pro-breastfeeding, but I'm also equally passionate about informed choice and people making the right choices for them and with, most crucially, the right information. And that's where we fall down, because sometimes we make what we think are good choices and then we find out later more information and regret our decisions. So I think, make whatever choice you like, but make it with the right information behind you.
Absolutely. And that is why you are here. And that brings me to the first question, which is what should you be considering when you are thinking about how you want to feed your baby?
Well, in any pregnancy, and within the UK, the NHS is obligated to give us an evidence base of information. They're supposed to give us leaflets. They're supposed to give us information antenatally. Often those conversations don't happen because their pregnancy has been a bit high risk, or because we're being managed by, not by our midwives, but by consultants, that kind of thing. And so some of that information gets missed out. So what I would say is go off and find someone who can help you get the information that you need to make the right decisions about feeding, but also about all kinds of things. I'm sure you'll be touching on birth, you'll be touching on parenting stuff. There's a huge range of information that is available from the NHS websites, from statutory organisations, from voluntary organisations, free and unbiased information that you can access. And just listening to stories of the people around you who've had babies before isn't necessarily the most helpful thing, because everyone is coloured by their own bias. It's all got their own experiences wrapped up in it. So wherever you've heard someone who had, a dreadful birth, or the baby was feeding every 3.5 minutes or their nipples nearly dropped off, or, they did this and it caused their baby to be sick, those things go in your head and plant seeds and will grow if you don't throw lots of actual evidence-based information in there. So getting informed is the first thing. There are a couple of NHS leaflets that we're all supposed to be given in our pregnancies. If you haven't received them, you can go online and look for them. The first one is called Off to the Best Start. That's an NHS leaflet under the Start for Life banner. And the other one is A Guide to Bottle Feeding. And the two of those are effectively the companion guide that give you all the information about breastfeeding and about bottle and formula feeding. And if you understand all of the information in there, and if you have questions and you've got someone to ask about them, that's the best thing. But if you've got all the information in there, you can start to make an informed choice. But there's there is a 24-page booklet with illustrations in it. It's not all the information. It's how to begin your conversation with yourself about what choice you want to make.
And that's it, isn't it? It is about taking the time to investigate. And one of the things that I know, through being pregnant after infertility is that can come later, I suspect, than a kind of natural pregnancy, perhaps, because you constantly don't want to you almost can't believe
you don't want to jinx it.
Exactly, and you don't want to jinx it, exactly. Yeah. And I know a lot of the things that people have done, you know, before me, and like my friends and family and things that they've done much earlier in the pregnancy, I certainly didn't do until after 24 weeks. And we had the viability, and that's when we started decorating the nursery, etc. But I really, really want to breastfeed personally. But even that, so I probably did start looking a little bit earlier, but I still know that there's, you know, so I've got an idea about things like colostrum, and but there's actually a lot more to it than I'd ever realised. And there's a lot that I don't know. And so especially if people are coming to it quite late on in their pregnancies, what could you just give us a quick overview of the kind of benefits and drawbacks for, we'll start with breastfeeding and then for formula feeding as well?
Yeah. Well, so some of the benefits for breastfeeding. I don't consider breastfeeding to have benefits in the sense that it's the biological norm. So in the same way as there's no benefit to a vaginal birth, there are drawbacks of cesarean. That doesn't mean in any way that I'm down on cesareans. I've had three myself, but I know what the drawbacks are. I don't consider that there are benefits of breastfeeding because it's what the baby's expecting. However, there are some health implications, and you know, breastfeeding, one of the kind of advantages, if you want to see it that way, these aren't health things at all. Some of the advantages include things like, you know, the mum gets to do it herself and feel like she's had the satisfaction of doing it herself. That can also be a drawback because you are the only one who can feed the child. Mm-hmm. You know, there's ways around that. Mum can express milk and someone else can bottle feed the child, but that is still an added burden on the mother. Mm-hmm. Some mothers absolutely love that it is all their own work, and they look at their chubby, happy baby and think, goodness me, I did that. And there's a huge amount of satisfaction in that. But obviously the drawback is it's absolutely exhausting to most mothers. And most mothers at some point think, what on earth have I let myself in for? This is ridiculous. How does anybody do this? They think, you know, it's just so overwhelming. But there is that immense satisfaction. In terms of, you know, if we're going to use the language of benefits, then health benefits to the baby, it's natural. It's what the baby is expecting. It's tailored to the child. We've had this lovely Easter weekend, bank holiday weekend in the UK, and it's been scorchio, and, you know, really lovely warm weather and everybody out in the sunshine. And I've had so many requests from mums saying, oh my goodness, my baby seems to be feeding all the time. That's because a breastfed baby doesn't need any extra water. The mum's body will accommodate and the baby will ask to feed little and often to get drinks of water when the weather's warm, because the mum's body absolutely tailor makes the milk for that child on that day. So understanding that kind of thing is fascinating. I really like the way that our immune system works in sort of conjunction with our newborn babies. And, you know, for the whole of the time we're breastfeeding, the mechanism between the breast and the baby is fascinating. So imagine the situation where little baby Billy has been left with, I don't know, your sister's little children, and one of your sister's children is incubating chickenpox, okay? And you can't see it and you don't know yet, but the little child is incubating chickenpox, and little Billy, who's maybe, what, 8 weeks old or something, has been around this child with chickenpox. And so when you get this child back, perhaps you've been to the hairdresser, you know, perhaps you've not been there for an hour and you haven't been around this child. When you get your baby back, the first thing that mothers tend to do is hold the baby up to their face and sniff them, as you do when you hug someone that you love and you fall into that big hug where you squeeze them and you actually breathe them in for a moment when you really love someone. You do the same with your baby. You pick them up and you smell them. And there's a thing called the bronchomammary pathway, which takes the information, the pathogens around the baby, and it takes them up into the nose and into the body. And within 30 seconds, the mother's body is capable of making an immune response to the pathogens that the baby has got around it. The same is true if the baby goes to the breast. There's these little bumps around the areola called Montgomery's tubercles, and they're kind of a two-way valve. And if the little baby has got something in its saliva that's some information about something it's dealing with, the mother's body can react and produce an antibody response to whatever that pathogen is within 30 seconds in the milk, and helps the baby to fight things off that it hasn't even got yet.
That is
which
fascinating.
It's astounding.
Yeah.
Never mind the fact that the protein and the water changes. It's set up to help the new baby who hasn't got its own immune system set up yet. The mother's body is supposed to do that with them until they can do it on their own.
Wow. I did not know any of that. That hasn't even come into my consideration for why I want to breastfeed. But hearing that, you just think, well, yeah, I definitely do. Although, you know, we do want to kind of just, yeah, we know that it's not always possible.
Yeah.
But that is fascinating.
But this is a reason for example, assume that baby Billy is actually only being breastfed once a day, okay. That mum is trying her absolute best, but it hasn't worked out for whatever reason. And she's been formula feeding. Either the baby's had a bit of weight loss or the mum's finding it too exhausting, or she's taking some medications twice a day. And she only really has one time in a day where the medication load would be too low enough that she feels confident breastfeeding. I should say, just to kind of throw it in there, there's lots of medications that you can take while breastfeeding. Actually, taking a medication is almost never a reason not to breastfeed, and there's a couple of services out there that can help. So don't just assume that you can't breastfeed because of a medication. You know, really, chemotherapy is the only big one, which will be a no-no. Okay. But to go back to this mum, imagine she's only able to breastfeed once a day when her load is lower, or, you know, when she's coping. The body is so clever that it will concentrate all of the immune factors that that baby needs into that one feed. So if you are finding yourself struggling and you are formula feeding, you don't have to beat yourself up. If you can give one feed a day, that's massively important. So it doesn't have to be all or nothing. There absolutely is a good justification for combination feeding rather than exclusively formula feeding.
Brilliant. Yeah, that's great.
Let me think of some other benefits to breastfeeding. You know, there's all of these sort of health things about the reduction in risk of cancers and heart problems. But it's finding your own personal thing that keeps you going, because it is undeniably a hard thing to start out doing. Mm-hmm. It's a huge ask of your body when your body's just had a baby. We're not societally set up to do it. There's all these expectations about how quick we will snap back into our jeans and all of that. And actually, if you just are sitting on the sofa munching on chocolate flapjacks and breastfeeding, you're probably not snapping back into your size 8 jeans at any time. But these health benefits, it's important to find the one that hits you. So I was told all sorts of stuff about cancers and heart attacks, and none of that hit me as a mother-to-be. What hit me was my husband had really bad eczema, and the risk of eczema is lower in a baby who's breastfed. So that was the thing that got me through it, was I felt I'd got to breastfeed because otherwise my poor child is going to end up like his dad, and he'll have eczema that cracks and bleeds and all of that. And so finding the thing that motivates you is the big thing. I didn't know about the immunity stuff either. You know, that's not something that had ever occurred to me either.
I will admit now, one of the things that makes me want to do it, and like, am I embarrassed to say this? Possibly not. But having spent tens of thousands of pounds on treatment, and my husband and I worked out the other day that we are actually out of pocket over almost £250,000 in total. And that's because of loss of earnings and that kind of thing, as well as the cost of the extra treatment. But financial, you know, it's free. Yeah. It's something that I can do. Well, you know,
the dispatches work that you talked about, I work really closely with the team on that. So I was involved in the calculations of how much formula costs, and, you know, those big piles of where they piled the infant milk on the floor. I was involved in like looking at how much that would cost and the difference between the brands and all of that. It is a massive cost, and breastfeeding is, you know, technically free. You would argue that some people are spending more on chocolate flapjacks, or, you know, there are lots of things that you can buy to supposedly support breastfeeding, whether they're bras or cushions or breast pads or breast pumps or, you know, things. But mostly it is that people want to make money out of people, and there are things that can be sold to people. We don't need to buy anything to breastfeed. Mm. And the cost of formula feeding, even just from the powder, never mind from the electricity and the buying of bottles and the sterilization and the cost of the heat and the electric and the water and all of that, is at least £10 a week.
Yeah.
Which, and if it's for some people it's a massive consideration. For me, I think it was more outrage and not wanting to line someone's pockets to that extent, really.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I know it is for us, it is a consideration, but one that I am very conscious, because of my sisters in particular, you know, that might not be, you know, I might not be able to see through to fruition. So, you know, hopefully I will. So sticking with breastfeeding just for a little bit longer. So something that I came across on, it was an Instagram profile actually, and it was about colostrum, something I'd never heard of before. I think some people call it liquid gold. Is that right?
Yeah.
And I'm going to go to a breastfeeding class at my local hospital, which is free. If you're in that situation, do have a look and see whether or not they are available. And I deliberately, because they were going to book it in quite close to my birth, and I was like, well, no, I know about colostrum. I want to start doing that before birth. And so I've booked it in. I think I'm going next week quite soon. But my loose research on colostrum is that I would start trying to get that from 37 weeks. Is that right? And how do I know I'll learn this in my class, but can you give us a kind of a bit of an idea about what that is, what it's like, what you do?
Yeah. Okay. So from about 18 or 20 weeks, the pregnant body has finished making the ducts in the breasts and done all the work it needs to do to make the breasts functional, and starts being able to make colostrum. And colostrum is a very, very potent, concentrated form of breast milk, effectively. The pregnancy hormones then keep the colostrum from being produced at that point. So some women find they leak a little bit, and most women find they don't, and that's perfectly fine through the pregnancy. But what it means is the moment that your baby is born, there is actually colostrum available. The moment that the placenta comes away, the hormones change, and that signals the change into the more mature milk-like milk. So colostrum, if you imagine it, it looks a little bit like golden syrup. It's tiny quantities, it's very thick, and it is, as you say, you know, we call it liquid gold because it is golden in colour often. It's not white. It's definitely not white. It can be more transparent, less coloured, but often it is more golden in colour. But as you say, babies are expecting this when they're born, but it's entirely possible to express colostrum antenatally. And increasingly we're finding that, particularly in high-risk pregnancies, it's a really advantageous thing to have some tiny syringes with, honestly, minute amounts of colostrum. We'd be very excited if you've got a mil here and a mil there, of colostrum to take in, that is, it's gathered antenatally. So as you say, from 36, 37 weeks, somewhere around there, it's hand expressed, and the technique for hand expressing is very simple. You're mimicking what a baby would do. You use your index finger and thumb, and you compress a part of the areola, the darker area around the nipple, about an inch back from where the base of the nipple is. Compress those two bits together, like with the amount of pressure you'd use to get a blob of toothpaste from a brand new tube of toothpaste. So very, very gentle pressure, compressed release, compressed release, compressed release, in a rhythm. At one point in the breast, sort of at 6 and 12 o'clock, if you see what I mean. And then you might move around to 5 pursed and whatever that would be, 5 pursed and 25 too, and just keep moving around the breast, compress and release until you start to get something. And you can gather those up and save them in little syringes, which your hospital will give to you, or which you can actually buy online. Put them in a sandwich bag, pop them in the freezer with the date on, and take them into hospital when you go. Because what we have now is some very strict criteria in order to make babies as healthy as they can be in NHS hospitals, where some babies, if they're at risk of hyperglycemia, which is low blood sugar, they are supposed to be. So, for example, if the mum's got gestational diabetes, or if the mum's on certain medications, or if she's got certain other conditions herself, or if the baby's had particularly rough birth, we're expecting that baby to be fed within half an hour of birth. We know that that produces the best outcomes. And a normal, healthy baby often doesn't want to feed within an hour of birth, or within half an hour of birth. They're still kind of coming round from being born, they're still familiarising themselves with the outside, they're having a nice skin-to-skin cuddle with mum, but they're not at the feeding stage yet. But we know that babies who are fed within half an hour have better outcomes in terms of blood sugars, So it makes sense to have these syringes of colostrum, which can then be used at that point and to support that baby to be fed with its own mother's milk, rather than needing to have any kind of artificial supplementation at that point where the mum's plan to breastfeed, you know, and that interrupts it. And it's, I can't tell you the difference it makes as a pregnant woman, knowing that you think you might breastfeed, but you are already worried that it won't work out and you have these doubts. And I think actually most pregnant women have those doubts that they might not be able to do it. And I think it's massively heightened in situations such as poor, you know, where they've been long time getting to this pregnancy, or whether it's been a very stressful pregnancy, high risk pregnancy. Most of those women have this little nagging voice inside their head that says, you won't be able to do this. Your body will let you down. And I think there's something very rewarding about having that antenatal colostrum, because you kind of, you're tipping your thumb a little bit to Mother Nature and saying, ha ha, I'm one step ahead of you. I totally can do this. I already have 7 millimeters of colostrum in my freezer. We're already ahead. And it's, we did a little study in our hospital, and the women who gather colostrum had a far higher breastfeeding rate by a factor of about 30%.
Wow.
than women who didn't gather any colostrum, who didn't attempt it. So it wasn't the women who didn't manage to get any. It's the ones who attempted it versus the ones who didn't attempt it. Mm-hmm. And almost everyone who attempted it got at least something, even if half a mil. And that's so potent and so full of antibodies and so full of things which actually trigger the baby to produce its own fuels from its own body, which actually, you know, use the ketones in the blood and the glycogen stored in the liver and actually trigger the baby to up its own blood sugar. It's almost like we were designed to do this, you know. Mm. It's very clever.
Yeah.
Colostrum is, as you say, liquid gold stuff. And the thing is, colostrum never runs out. So you've got it at the end of your pregnancy, but there is always colostrum in the milk, no matter how old the baby is that you're feeding. It's just that other things like water and calcium and vitamins and stuff have increased. So it's never not suitable. So even if you express some, you don't need it in the hospital because feeding goes beautifully, and you remember a couple of days later, there are worse things that you could do than give it to your child anyway.
Right.
You know? Filled okay. with brilliant stuff. Don't throw it away.
No, definitely. And something that is on your website, which I don't know if we'll get to talk about now, that I've only come across recently, is milk banking, which perhaps, you know, yeah. we will talk about on another episode perhaps, or yeah, people yeah. can look up. And that's about donating your milk, isn't it? Any excess milk yeah, that yeah. you don't need.
Well, I think it's worth a quick mention in the sense that if you are struggling with breastfeeding on a hospital ward and the cry goes up that you should supplement, you can ask on the hospital ward about donated milk. They might not suggest it because it won't be part of their protocol. But if you say, well, look, I have a high risk of all these things and you told me to breastfeed and now you're telling me that I should use formula and you told me that formula would be have a risk of these things, and actually I would like some donated milk, and some hospitals will give it. So it's completely postcode lottery. But it's worth an ask.
We're very used to postcode lottery, us fertility.
I gathered.
Yeah, we are very used to that, sadly. And then the very final thing on breastfeeding is, you know, I guess this would be a drawback, but this is, and again, this is because of my own personal experience with someone in my family, but it's mastitis. And the person yeah. I'm talking about ended up back in hospital, and it was one of the reasons that they then found it really difficult to continue breastfeeding. So
yeah,
can
yeah.
you talk to us a little bit, just so we're prepared and how we could perhaps prevent or treat quickly or that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, I think it's awful that we have to prepare ourselves for the worst, but I think certainly families in the position that you're describing, you know, you want to be prepared for the worst. This is how you function.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very wise. So one of the biggest issues with breastfeeding is that the baby is not attached at the breast in an effective and comfortable way. And particularly women who are really driven to breastfeed at all costs will slam the baby on in any direction so long as the baby is getting fed, because there is this desire to give yourself. I mean, I think most mums, if I'm honest, will use the word persevere and, well, I can bear it, and as long as my baby's getting fed, that's all that matters to me. Well, it isn't all that matters. If there is damage to the nipple, damage to the breast tissue because of the way the baby's feeding, if they're feeding with a very shallow latch rather than a big wide open mouth and a nice big wide mouth of breast, they can damage the tissue, they can cause cracks in the tissue, and they can cause blockages in the breast where the breast is trying to make the milk to come forward to the nipple, but one area of it, it actually gets a little bit of a blockage and the milk can't get through, and that can get worse, and the body then decides it's an infection. So the body reacts to it as if it is an outside foreign body. And this thing called mastitis is an inflammation of an area of the breast. And often it's a big, hot, hard quadrant of the breast, usually behind a block duct, usually in the area where the crack is on the nipple, if there's a crack on the nipple. And it might not be infected. It might just be the body reacting to it. Sometimes it's infected, and it actually does require antibiotics. Sometimes it actually can turn into a gathering of infection, excuse me, within the breast, and can lead to something like an abscess inside the breast. And all of these things can be avoided by getting good expert and experienced support with breastfeeding from the beginning. So somebody who really knows how to talk you through. I mean, you can get lucky. Lots of women get lucky and just manage to breastfeed anyway. But if you're having any problems, throw the word persevere out of your head and go looking for someone who can help you. It's definitely worth the investment. And there are, you know, there are some brilliant voluntary sector breastfeeding support people in the UK. We've got some very educated midwives and some very educated health visitors. We also have a huge number of midwives and health visitors who haven't had the right education and don't have the right knowledge. So just keep asking until you find somebody. And they might try to help, but you will recognise, you know, you guys will be able to sniff out whether somebody knows what they're talking about or not. This is what you do. So go find somebody. But mastitis can be treated with anti-inflammatories. It can be treated with antibiotics. Mostly what you want to do is get rid of whatever's causing the problem. So getting rid of the damage to the nipple, getting rid of the blockage, making the baby attach at the breast in a way which is effective and drains the breast effectively. You know, nobody wants you to be in pain, but there is a real desire amongst the woman who's really passionate about just getting this done that they almost carry on past the point where it's sensible. Yeah, it's like wearing, I often say it's like wearing a pair of, you know, you buy a really beautiful pair of shoes and you're desperate to wear this beautiful pair of shoes, but they rub and they give you blisters. And our sort of reaction as a society is to put a plaster on the blister so it doesn't rub that bit anymore, rather than to not buy shoes that hurt our feet, rather than to take these shoes and actually have that little bit stretched out, or, you know, add something into it, which is what we would have done back in the day. Now we buy shoes and you just go, oh, those ones hurt my feet, I'll wear a different pair. So don't let it hurt your feet, don't let it hurt your boobs.
No, ask someone.
Ask
look
someone.
For information,
yeah.
Look for support.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
And don't believe that it does just hurt. Pain is a sign there's something wrong. So
pay attention to that. And I have to say that I haven't asked a lot of people these questions, because you don't look up, you don't want to ask, because you're so scared that it's never going to happen to you. So in the limited conversations or the limited research I've done, you know, people do say it's hard, it's tough. Persevere is definitely a word that I'm sure has come up.
It's one of my least favourite words, I have to say. I don't enjoy the word persevere at all. I think that's a horrible thing to make women do.
Yeah, no, fair enough, especially after having gone through so much as well. But I guess it's a balance between, you know, trying, and this is something new. This is something you haven't done before. This is something that, you know, sometimes works, sometimes doesn't, and asking for support and information and guidance on it. And there is a balance between that, but it isn't being in pain and persevering beyond.
We have a national breastfeeding helpline, 9:30 till 9:30 every day, run by two of the voluntary services organisations, Breastfeeding Network and the Association of Breastfeeding Mothers. The phone number is 0300 100 0212. And they're all trained to deal with anything you can throw at them on the phone. And they're run by, it's volunteers in their own home. So sometimes the phone might just ring out. It'll go around a few people, but often you'll get someone quite quickly, or someone will get back to you quite quickly. And they're trained to support on the phone. They are only peer supporters. They are there to offer information and support. They're not experts. They are really experienced peer supporters. So there's a difference. I'm a board certified lactation consultant, and my colleagues are for more complex stuff, for more tailored stuff. You know, where we work in private practice, we might be able to spend 2 hours in someone's home, which is a very different thing to 5 minute conversation on the phone. And it's not, you know, they're not all equal, but don't underestimate the power of just talking to someone on the phone for something like mastitis, for something like sore nipples, for something like, is my baby feeding enough? Why is my baby not pooing? You know, ask. We have a national breastfeeding helpline. Ask for help.
Brilliant. And I'll put the details of that in the show notes as well, for sure.
Fabulous. Yeah.
So I feel like I have, yeah, kind of taken over with the breastfeeding. So formula feeding. Yeah. So whether that is because of a personal reason or a physical reason, or, you know, that you've tried to do the breastfeeding and that hasn't worked out for one reason or another, whether it's a completely personal choice that you want to formula feed, you know, like, can you talk to us about that? And I've got a bit more of an idea after watching your dispatches program about the different brands and things and about what's given to you in the hospitals, you know, what's good, bad and ugly about that. But if you could talk to us about that, that would be amazing.
Okay, so this baby that has been born deserves to be fed in a responsive, gentle, held in the mum's arms way. So there's a few things, you know, obviously we've all heard this mantra of breast is best, but it's not helpful in any way. And if a family has chosen to formula feed, if a family has chosen to breastfeed and ended up formula feeding because they haven't had the right information, they haven't managed to get the right support, you know, there's, heaven knows, so many families where it just is, it just feels completely too hard and they end up formula feeding for whatever reason. But whether you've chosen it or it's chosen you, the most important things are how we feed the baby and how we make the milk up. So as you say, from the dispatches, it isn't which brand you choose. The main thing I would say is, what the only milk you will ever need, unless your baby has a special medical condition, the only milks you will ever need are what we call first stage infant milks. There is no need for a hungrier baby. There is no need for a comfort milk. There is no need for a follow-on milk. There are no need for toddler milks past the age of 12 months. First stage infant milk suitable from 0 to 12 months. And you can buy that from supermarkets and chemists across the land, many different brands available. And we have very clear European Food Standards Agency and international guidance on what has to be in the formula by law, minimums and maximum amounts, and what cannot be or should not be or needs to be below minimum amounts. So you can pick anyone you like. Pick one that matches your kitchen interior. You know, pick the one that's available in your local shop. Pick the one that your Auntie Sarah used. Whatever you want, it really doesn't matter. There are some different ingredients in the different formulas, but we have absolutely no way of knowing whether they are better or worse for the baby, because if the evidence showed that one thing or another thing that the formula companies make a claim about was actually beneficial, they would all have to have it in by law, because we do try to protect our babies. So what's more important than the choice of brand? And as you say, the dispatches documentary looked in some detail at the pricing structure and the difference between the most expensive and the least expensive. And I have to say, they called that the most expensive, but you can pay twice and even three times as much as that for a formula in the UK if you buy, you know, a goat's milk one or something fancy. Absolutely no need. The most important thing is that you choose a method of feeding, a bottle that is easy to clean and sterilise. So anything that's got these anti-colic valves and extra little tubes in and all of that, it makes it harder for them to be cleaned and sterilized, which makes you gives you a bigger risk with the contamination of those bottles. It's milk we're putting in them, and milk grows bacteria extremely well. All powdered formula has bacteria in it. It is impossible to sterilize a powder that you are going to consume. You can only sterilize it with nasty chemicals or with radiation, neither of which would be a good thing for a baby. So they're all unsterile and have bacteria in. And the way that we make them safe for infants is by making the milk up safely by using very, very hot water. So they say 70 degrees. and using very hot water to make the milk up, that kills off the pathogens in the powder, and then cooling the bottle to feed it to the child, because clearly you don't feed a baby a 70-degree bottle of formula. Rather than using these machines, which use a little bit of hot water and then cool water, or rather than using previously boiled water that you've cooled down, or not making it up with the right temperature water, the most important thing is that it's made up with a ratio of 1 scoop to 1 ounce, or however it is you're doing it, whether you're doing it in mils or ounces, as it says on the package, with 1 scoop to 1 ounce of hot water, following the manufacturer's instructions on the packaging. And then that it's fed to the baby in a responsive, paced, gentle, nurturing way. So the baby is held in your arms. Why should the baby miss out on a nice cuddle with its carer, with its grown up, with its mummy, hopefully, or daddy, rather than, everyone from the neighbourhood? Why should it miss out on those little lovely cuddles just because it's being bottle fed? And, you know, looking around, and not to be judgy, but looking around, if you're sitting in the local cafe or whatever, you often see mums holding the baby's in the pram and the bottle's being put in the baby's mouth at arm's length. And it's convenient, but it isn't right for the baby. It's not nurturing for the baby. So I would rather that babies were held in mum's arms and bottle fed in a way where they're not encouraged to take the whole feed, but they take what they want. You know, I would rather, if someone served me dinner, be able to eat what I want and leave the rest and not feel like I'd got to eat it all. Actually, I'm quite greedy and I will eat everything that's put in front of me. And some babies are like that, but I think it's really sensible to effectively give smaller portions more frequently and let the baby tell you when they're hungry. So they used to call it feeding on demand. They call it baby-led feeding, responsive feeding, well, however you want to term it. It's the idea that we're letting the baby set the pace rather than 4 ounces every 3 hours on the dot. It's more, you know, if the baby wants to feed after an hour and a half, we all do sometimes, you're a bit more peckish. You have a small amount and then you move on again. So for me, that's more important. Make it up safely, feed it in a loving and responsive way. That's how the baby will get the least, as it were, disadvantage from not being breastfed. That you can make it as much like that nurturing experience, as much like, you know, not stretching the tummy by feeding it big feeds, and making sure that it's properly winded afterwards, popping the baby up onto your shoulder and making sure that it gets a chance to get its wind up, so that it's, you know, you don't need to smack its back or anything like that, just gently pop it upright and keep them upright after a feed, actually whether they're breast or formula fed. So they're comfy and it's a nice experience for them rather than just something they have to do to get through the day. So those would be my top tips, really. Sterilising and cleaning the bottles, making sure the milk's made up right, and feeding it in a lovely way. And pick whichever one you want, whichever one makes you happy. And be not afraid to swap formula if you want to. If you feel like it doesn't suit your child, there is nothing to stop you from buying another one, because they're all supposed to be very similar.
Yeah, I guess you don't think about that, do you? Like, are they different flavours? Like, not flavours, but, you know, do they taste different kind of thing?
And they might do, because they have got slightly different ingredients. But the thing that most people don't kind of grasp is actually the formula companies themselves will change the ingredients in their formula all the time, because they're based on market forces. So they need a particular, you know, they need a particular protein or they need a particular oil, and they will buy whatever's cheapest on the market. So they will change, and over time they will change. So it kind of doesn't matter if you're moving from brand, you know, 3 to brand 4. Doesn't really matter.
No, fair enough. And again, like, and I've seen the program, so, and I highly recommend anyone have a look at it. I think it's fascinating whether you're going to breastfeed or formula feed, to be honest. Down to a marketing thing, like one of the things you mentioned there is, you know, if there's research behind it, it's in there, which is something that we as fertility patients, with the whole add-ons and everything, you know, we're very aware of, you know, well, you could do this, and there's no evidence behind it. So the really amazing thing with this versus, you know, the fertility side of things is the babies, you know, they are looked after. If there is the research, and if the research says it should be in there, then it will be in all of them.
But remember that some of the most expensive brands, particularly, they're constantly trying new things in those formula that aren't. It's not that they have to be evidence-based to be in there. But if they have to be in there, then there's an evidence base for it. So yeah. The things that they say on the packaging are where they make claims about particular things on the packaging. I mean, go and have a look in the supermarket, read the packaging. The things that they make the claims about in the packaging are things that don't have to be in there by law.
Right.
Because if they have to be in there by law, they wouldn't be allowed to advertise them.
No. And the advertising thing is what you had said again in the programme, that they're not allowed legally to advertise or market the baby, the kind of newborn, the first one.
The milk I'm saying that you should have.
Yeah.
Yeah. They can only advertise the ones that you don't ever need.
Which is why they do it, just literally from a marketing point of view. It's amazing, isn't it? It's incredible when you hear things like that.
They just want your money.
Yeah. See, I would be going for the cheapest one, and I would have guilt about that. But it's good to hear.
Don't have guilt.
Yeah, there's no guilt.
Put the money aside for your child to have ballet lessons or trumpet lessons later on,
Perfect. No, that's good to hear, definitely. We have touched upon it a little bit. Things like if you're breastfeeding, you're doing all the work, you can express and into bottles and someone else can feed. If you are formula feeding, that is easier, for anyone. But what you're saying is kind of for mum or partner to do the feeding.
Well, the baby's just expecting one person.
Really?
The baby is expecting mum to feed them. That's the biological norm, isn't it? So we're trying to keep it as biologically normal as possible for that child.
But it's not a bad thing to, because, I know with my husband or with other people's partners, you want them to be involved in that, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as a mother of three, many people have fed my breastfed children with express milk over the years. And as a mum of three cesarean babies, I know about the biological norm. I recognise the biological norm. I have made other choices. I have done other things, but I think it's important to recognise and make the informed choice yourself.
Definitely. No, that does make sense for sure. And I don't, it's weird to kind of liken it, and I'm just thinking this, or I'm saying it as I'm thinking it, so I don't quite know how this is going to come out. But when you do IVF, you as the woman, or as the woman in my relationship, I'm the one that's injecting and taking the medication and going through the process of egg collection and transfer, etc. But my husband does as much as
they
he
just can. Have to live with you.
Well, there is a little bit of that, but what he tends to do is he'll put together the injections and prepare stuff so that I don't have that in my head. And I guess with the whether you're expressing and then, using bottles, or whether you're formula feeding, and so all of the sterilization and everything that comes with that, you are, which also comes with breastfeeding, I appreciate. It's about getting someone else involved in that bit as well.
Absolutely.
And them playing a part in being one of the parents.
Absolutely. So, there's this horrible thing that is often said to the dads or the non-breastfeeding parent of a breastfed baby, which is, well, you can do the nappies. And I always just think, well, that is literally a bum deal.
Yay.
I'm not saying that you might not bond during the nappy, but there's plenty of time when babies are being neither fed nor having the bum changed. There's winding you can do from very early on, maybe even 2 or 3 weeks in. Babies are very responsive. They love faces. They want to chat to somebody. They want to vocalize. They want to have those bonding times. And I think it's really lovely for the non-feeding partner to be recognising the investment that the breastfeeding mum is making into having that baby and breastfeeding that baby and doing what she believes to be the best. And the nurture of that mother is very important. But it doesn't mean that their only job is just to sit there and say, wow, you're great. Yes, they can make sure she's got a drink. They can make sure she's comfortable. They can be her cheer squad and they can just recognize that she's doing a good job. But there's plenty of other things to do with babies. My kids, I've got all boys, and my husband has not got a problem with bonding with my kids, in spite of the fact that they were all selfishly breastfed by me for, over a year each. My husband is plenty bonded with his kids because they're nice to cuddle.
Yeah, that's it. Just get involved, both of you. Get involved, if there's two of you. Yeah, definitely. And if there's a wider kind of community of people and family around you, it's just about loving that baby, isn't it? And doing what's right and looking after yourself, I guess, as a new mum, as a new parents, and allowing a lot of people to help you and support you. But yeah. also, you know, and I guess that's why it's good to listen to things like this now, because we don't know how we're going to feel once we have the babies, you know, and something that I'm talking about in a different episode.
Exhausted.
Absolutely.
And, if you're doing it right, you will be exhausted.
This is it. And you won't necessarily have the confidence and the ability to kind of, you know, stand up for yourself necessarily. And so I think it's the more we can learn now, even if it is in a short window of belief, right towards the end of our pregnancies, hopefully that will make things easier once the little ones are here. So,
yes.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Shell. There is so much more we could talk about. You know, and there were other points that we possibly thought might come up, but, you know, I might have to have you back. If this makes a second second series, then I might well ask you back because, yeah, there's lots more to talk about. But I really, really appreciate you sharing your amazing knowledge and information. I'll put the details that I mentioned in the show notes so people can find you. They can find your webinars. They can find that helpline that we talked about and the leaflets. And they can contact you, you know, if they wanted to kind of work with you on any one-to-one sessions, that kind of thing as well. Yeah. Via that.
I'm really grateful you've given me this opportunity, actually, because I think that families in this situation, there's so much pressure, there's so much, you know, medicalization of the situation you're in, that in my experience, you do often find it much harder to just get on with being a parent once the baby is healthy and here, because you hadn't prepared yourself for that. So, go and arm yourself with the knowledge that you can do this and you just need the right information and support from good people.
That's it. Brilliant. Thank you so much, Shell. I really, really appreciate it and enjoy the rest of your Easter.
You too. Cheers.